glimpses of truth that for me open mine eyes, illumine me, Spirit divine.
Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program I explore what I call a shifting paradigm in the consciousness of the planet, of humanity, and we are defining our worlds in different ways, and tonight's guest is very much at the forefront of a shift in paradigm. He's Dr. Larry Dossey, and his books have been a major influence on this change in consciousness. His latest book is The Power of Premonitions, and he'll be in New York this Thursday, March 18th, talking about the power of premonitions at the auditorium of the New York City Blood Center. That's 310 East 67th Street. And you can check on the FIONS website, the Friends of the Institute of Noetic Science website. Dr. Dossey, Larry, are you there?
Yeah, Alan.
Yeah,
great to be with you.
Great to be with you.
Yes, great to be with you, too, because looking over the content of the book Power Premonitions, there's so many questions about that just come to me. So premonitions are these inklings of future events that come to everyone, you say. Is there a better how would you define this idea of premonitions?
Well, a premonition, if you go back to the origin of the word, which is the Latin, it means a forewarning. So that sort of gives you a clue about what these things are like. They usually do warn us of things that are reasonably unpleasant. For example, they might have to do with a health crisis that lies in the future, or some sort of physical event, such as a car crash, a crashing plane, or something that dramatic. On the other hand, they're not all warnings of dire experiences. For example, people have all sorts of premonitions of nice things as well, premonitions about a job promotion or something even trivial, like where the last remaining parking spot in Manhattan might be, for example. So they come in many flavors. They warn us of terrible things and nice things as well. They also occur in dreams as well as in the waking state. So there really is a huge spectrum of what these things look like.
Right. I mean, I've had premonitions. I had a friend come to me in a dream and telling me to pull a tooth that was giving me a hard time. And I didn't want to do it. And it took me a year to finally actually have that tooth pulled. But it came to me in a dream out of nowhere, this message.
That's pretty typical. I have a whole file cabinet of these sorts of things. And it's not uncommon for these to be so symbolic that people really have a hard time in getting their minds around what they might indicate. There's one case in the book I talked about in which a woman, for every night for a year, dreamt that a nurse came to her and held a light to her lower leg, and she didn't have a clue about what this meant, but a year later, she erupted in a horrible case of osteomyelitis, or bone infection, right at the spot where the nurse was shining the light. So sometimes the meaning of these things are not just entirely obvious. We sort of have to be with them and often let them announce their own meaning to us over time.
Well, you don't think that was a negative thing, do you? I'm not saying there are those things, but maybe if it's right at that light, you think it would have prevented some type of infection at that spot?
Well, that's a possible interpretation, but I think that was not a negative event. I think it was a heads up, and that was the interpretation that this woman chose to make of that. I really believe that in most cases, these things are trying to do us a huge favor. I think that if we take them seriously, as many people learn to do, we will avoid things that are fairly injurious or negative in our lives. For that reason, I think they have survival value in so many cases.
Well, yeah, that's the premise. That's one of the premises in the book, is these things are embedded within the spectrum of our consciousness that helps us survive, you know, possible catastrophes, right? And survival as a species. But a bigger picture behind all of this is, what is this reality that exists that this information is coming from and intersecting with who we are as consciousness? You know, there's a much bigger picture happening all around us that these events seem to be lining up. And do you have an idea of how they, let's call it the landscape of these multidimensional aspects of ourselves exist?
Yeah, I do. And there are several possible models to talk about, which I describe at length in the book. I think the thing that we have to do, if we have a hope of getting our minds around these experiences, is to take a larger view and perspective of what the nature of our consciousness is, and also what the nature of time is. You know, science, conventional classical Newtonian science, doesn't have a place for this sort of thing, because it says that time flows in one direction. You cannot have information running backwards in time, carrying information about what's going to happen to you in the present. That just is not possible. But there certainly are allowances made for that in certain interpretations of quantum physics. There are physicists now who are fiddling with what are called closed time-like loops, where time may in the future circle back to the present, carrying with it information that you might interpret in the present as a premonition. So fiddling with the nature of time is one way to make a place for this. But my prejudice, I must confess, is to really rethink the nature of consciousness, to consider it what I call non-local, which simply means infinite in space and time. And if we do that, then we say that consciousness operates outside the brain and the body, even outside the present moment, so that there are no absolute barriers to the acquisition of information from the future. Consciousness is already there. This is a huge stretch. Excuse me, go ahead.
No, I like what you're saying there, sorry. I just was getting the idea that there are, and we're just kind of hypothesizing, are there two kind of parallel tracks to events? I mean, you talk about the woman who had the premonition of a chandelier dropping on her baby's crib. So she chose to act on that premonition, baby out of the crib, and then the chandelier crashed, I guess, moments later or a little bit later. Now, she could have not acted. The chandelier still would have crashed, probably, and then, of course, things would have happened to the baby. So we can ignore it, but it's like that chandelier was already geared to do what it did, and yet human will intersects with events of the world. I don't quite understand, and I don't know if anyone does, how that really works, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
well, I think...
Go ahead.
So my view of that particular anecdote, and just to sort of bring people up to speed with us, let me just kind of briefly describe what we're talking about. This is a case in the book of a young mother I call Amanda. She had a horrible nightmare one night that a chandelier fell from the ceiling in her infant's room and crashed into the crib and destroyed the baby and just demolished the crib. Also, one of the aspects of that story is that in the dream, she saw a clock in the baby's room that read 4:35 in the morning. So she wakes up, can't go back to sleep. She's absolutely horrified. She wakes her husband, tells him about it. He poo-poos it and says, you know, it's just a dream. Go back to sleep. But she can't. She gets up and goes and brings the baby back to the bed with them. And a couple of hours later, they're awakened by a crash. They go in, and sure enough, chandelier has fallen and wrecked the crib. She looks at the clock, and it indeed reads 4:35. Mm. So she had a very accurate premonitory dream in camera-like detail. Now, so how do we interpret that? My view is that the future is not fixed. We may get a glimpse of it, but we glimpse it in its probabilistic state. It's not written in stone. There is room to, in the present, maneuver and make choices and act and exercise our intentions to shift the probability of the future events in one direction or another. I think that's what she did. She saw a likely event, but intervened with her own intentions and choices to shift the probabilities in a more benign direction. Now, people can line up any way they wish.
Right, but yet the chandelier somehow was set to fall, whether she acted or not. I mean, there's events in the world that seem to be almost independent of human action, but in some way also dependent on human action, you know?
Well, yeah, I agree. And there are some events that we intuit or have a premonition about that are much more difficult to intervene with than others. And some are easier to manipulate by taking action in the present. You know, bear in mind, Ellen, that she also saw her baby being killed in that dream, right? Not just the chandelier falling. She saw her baby demolished. Mm. But she took action so that did not happen. Mm. So she didn't totally shift the future perception, but she certainly modified it in a way that saved her child's life.
And you say we all, and I think it's true, we all have this power within us. I mean, another example for me was the summer of 2001, where I felt like I just could not sleep in New York City. I just had a horrible time sleeping all through July and August, and I went to Hawaii, and then, you know, the whole 9/11 2001 thing happened, and I think if I would have been here, I probably would have ran down there. Who knows? But something was telling me not to be in New York at that time. So I don't know.
I'm glad you bring up the 9/11 experience, because I think that there is some indirect evidence that premonitions or instinct or gut feelings or however we want to call these things was possibly playing a huge role for a lot of people that day. Mm. In the book, I talk about the vacancy rates on those four doomed planes on 9/11. A lot of people have the idea that, you know, there were four jam-packed full passenger jets that went down that day, but that's not the way it worked. The average vacancy rate on all four planes was 80%, 79 to 80%. So a lot of people found some reasons not to travel that day. Now, I don't want to come down too firm on the interpretation of that, but it's within the realm of possibility that a lot of people were going on some gut feelings that accounted for only a 20% occupancy rate. I think that's pretty strange. I fly a lot, and I just don't get on very many airplanes that are only 20% full.
Right, right. And what about the Roger Nelson project with the, you know, electronic coin toss? Do you mention that? Where the
Global project, Global Consciousness project, where he has scores of what are called random number or random event generators stationed around the world. And they're spitting out random numbers of zeros and ones with an even distribution until something happens in which people's consciousness comes together in a kind of a coherent state. And then these things start becoming non-random. This is the weirdest thing. It seems that consciousness has some sort of collective capacity to shift random probabilities in one direction or another. These things have been running for years, and when major events happen, then the shift happens in the output of the machines. One of the most major deviations occurred just before 9/11.
Yeah, actually 4 hours before, they said there was started to be some coherency within the randomness that, well, they didn't know what it would be, but it alerted people to something might happen, and then there it was, you know. So,
right.
But I'm trying to get a sense, and I think it hasn't been defined, and I think you're the closest to, I guess, understanding this interface between time, consciousness, free will, because I think free will is very much involved in who we are as conscious beings on the planet. But how would you create a bigger picture of reality? Yes, that involves consciousness, but what else? What else do we have to be aware of to create a new paradigm for consciousness?
Well, I think we can talk about some of the qualities of consciousness that seem to be necessary for these sorts of phenomena to happen that we've been talking about. I'll give you an example of what I mean. If you look at premonitions across the board, they seem to occur between people who have some deeply empathic, loving, compassionate connection with each other. The case of Amanda and her infant that we were just talking about is a classic example of that. If you looked at all of the patterns and motifs that crop up in premonitions, the mother-child motif is one that just is there so much of the time. You also see people having premonitions about the welfare of others they love, siblings, lovers, parent and child. And so these things suggest that deep compassion and caring and love really are some sort of vital ingredient for these non-local manifestations of consciousness to happen. Now, why is that? Well, I guess we'd have to ask the Creator if there is one, but what we can do is just simply unpack these phenomena and try to sort out what has to be there for them to happen. And so this compassionate element is one that is a very persistent kind of factor that's present over and over in so many of these things.
Well, maybe love creates coherency within the vibration of beings.
Well, that's one way of putting it. Whether that's a metaphor or something more than a metaphor is very difficult to say. But I am convinced that we're on solid ground to talk about the importance of love and these premonition phenomena. Alan, I bumped into this, the importance of love, years ago in writing books on remote healing and prayer. And,
yes.
It just is there in stark reality that in these experiments, looking at remote healing and healing intentions, if love and compassion are absent, these experiments just don't work. That's another example of the power or the importance of love and compassion and how consciousness manifests in the world.
So love is a force. I mean, it seems like it's not just a metaphor. Love is actually maybe a measurable force, a force of intention, a force of coherency. It's something the human being can emanate from within them to affect other people in the nature of reality.
Well, I think that's well said.
Yeah. So if we're going to make it a science, I mean, not that there could be a science of love, but, you know, it's very much what we're trying to do in this new era of consciousness is merge the spiritual quality with our rational or meta-rational type of understanding. I mean, I think that the Institute of Noetic Science is trying to do, they're trying to create a new science based on these phenomena, I mean, how could we explain this to a more mainstream audience in terms of a science?
Well, I've had a lot of practice trying trying to do that. I have the opportunity to talk to groups of skeptical physicians at medical schools all over the country about this premonition, these premonition phenomena, and also the remote distant healing phenomena that I mentioned. So my approach is to approach this as a science and ask the question, what's the data? What's the evidence behind any of this? And both issues, the healing phenomena and premonitions, there are a host of randomized, prospective, double-blind, controlled studies that showing this stuff is real. That's the approach I take with physicians. I wouldn't even attempt to have an intelligent conversation with them if I didn't have some data. But the fact that, but there is a science here. It passes for good science as well. As evidence of that, almost, well, over 90 of the nation's 150 medical schools now have courses devoted to looking at the science in the double-blind, randomized controlled studies in healing. We can go into... Yeah, go ahead.
No, no, that's good. I didn't know that. No, continue, please.
Yeah, and so if you look at the area of premonitions, there are three areas now where the science is terrific, showing that we're not fooling ourselves when we talk about the ability of people to see the future. There are over 20 controlled, replicated studies now that have been done by different people around the world that are computer-based, showing that people sitting in front of a computer can register in their bodies by a stress response the type of picture that's going to be shown on the computer screen before it even happens.
Right.
These are wild. And people have a hard time
Dean
believing
Dean Radin's
these.
Work, right? Was that the work of Dean Radin who does that?
Yeah, very good. Yeah, that's Radin pioneered these studies, but they've been replicated now by many, many different people. There's no easy way to explain these away. I mean, they've been replicated. They're really solid. There are no good arguments against them. And that's only one area. In the field of remote viewing, studies have been done at Princeton at the PEAR Lab and over 300 experiments showing that people can know in great detail the information that will later be selected and sent to them by another distant person. This is called precognitive remote viewing. And then there are online experiments that give staggering odds against chance of billions against one, where people can take what are called precognitive computer-based tests in which they predict what the computer is going to do in terms of selecting different cards or different images and so on before that choice is even made by the computer. What I'm telling you is that there is a science here. It comports with the rules of excellent science. These are randomized controlled studies, and they've been replicated. So there's your science for premonitions. I think most people with an open mind who look at this come away fairly impressed.
Well, that's the science, but it seems like we are so confined in our thinking through science of what is possible that we have to actually expand how we think as well as just the science of this. It's like you said, I think it's something to do with consciousness being a non-local phenomena, meaning that whatever consciousness is not located in time and space as we know it. So we can call it science, and it's great work you're doing, but we have to also modify what science is. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, we have to modify as well what we mean by consciousness. And
yes.
I think this is where the new reality comes in. I mean, the old reality is that consciousness is just some sort of epiphenomenon of the brain. It resides inside the cranium. It may affect your body, but it can't do anything out there in the world. That image just won't work anymore. It has to be discarded in place of an image that permits consciousness to operate outside the present and outside the confines of the body. That's where we're headed with this. There's no way to avoid redefining consciousness. That is the new way, Alan. We're going to have to learn to think. The only other choice is to ignore the data, and that's bad science, right? You cannot toss out data to just defend your pet theory of a limited localized consciousness. That's a desecration of science. So
that's what scientists, you know, I forgot who said that science progresses one funeral at a time, you know. And
right.
So go ahead. I mean, you're saying that.
Well, I just think that this is a terrific time to be alive and, you know, kicking and talking about these ideas, because we are on a threshold where it is clear that the old images of consciousness are just not going to work any longer. You know, this is radical stuff for people who think that this is woo-woo California talk and so on. It's not the first time that we've had we've hit a brick wall in science and have had to really scramble to come up with new ideas of reality. The most wrenching event was in the quantum relativity revolution that took place in the first part of the 20th century. You know, there are still people who refuse to believe that. So, you know, this thing about science changing funeral by funeral, there's a lot of truth to that. But, you know, our choice is to either do good science or fall back on bigotry and prejudice. And you know where I stand.
Right. No, I think it's great work that you're doing, because the other level of this is this, the point of view of reality, objectivity or subjectivity. I think science has to start to recognize that reality is based on a subjective approach to the world. If you look at it as objectively, you treat yourself as an object, but if you see it subjectively, you are the subject of your reality. I forgot who said that, but it really stood out for me. So there has to be a way of verifying reality that trusts the personal experience. Like, these people cannot deny these premonitions were real. They worked for them. They saved lives. You have to go along with it. And we have to somehow create a future science that will validate experience.
Well, I think that I certainly agree with you, because I know that people's stories and the anecdotes can be supplemented with hardcore experiments that show that we can sense the future. We can know the future before it happens, so we're not fooling ourselves when we say we have this ability. Now, there are a lot of skeptical cynics out there in science who still maintain, in spite of all of that this stuff is just nonsense. They will fall back on the old standbys that this is just hallucinations, this is just fantasies, these are poor memories, they're memory substitutions, people just believe what they want to believe, and there's no way that you will convince someone otherwise who goes into this conversation thinking that these things are impossible in principle. I've spent a good deal of time in dialogue with skeptics, and some are incorrigible. They will go to their graves thinking that the rest of us are nuts. But that's fine. I mean, that, you know, that's their choice. You know, I just this week went back and reviewed some of the great chapters in skepticism and modern science, and the one that really speaks to me, because it seems to be replayed over and over again in our day, was what happened in the late 1700s when the French Academy of Sciences refused to believe that meteorites were real. They were a group of hotshot scientists, the best in their day, who said, since stones cannot fall from the sky, they do not fall from the sky. Therefore, meteorites do not exist. This was their logic. They thought it was airtight. But then what happened in April in 1803 is that 3,000 meteorites in a huge meteorite shower fell in Normandy, and it was witnessed by thousands of people in plain daylight. And so the French government sent a physicist there to investigate and came back and said, yeah, 3,000 stones did fall from the sky. And so the French Academy of Science had to eat their words. And they said, well, I guess, you know, stones do fall from the sky. So the parallels about skepticism these days is very close to that. We have scientists, neurophysiologists in particular, saying that consciousness does not exist apart from the brain. Consciousness is the same thing as the brain. Hence, consciousness cannot operate outside the brain. It's meteorites all over again.
Right.
So I would just say good luck in arguing with these folks. They seem to be immune to evidence, and I suppose that a good number of them will indeed go to their grave thinking that they're right and the rest of us are crazy.
Well, I've been involved in what let's call it New Age thought or consciousness thought, and all of it points to actually that consciousness totally exists outside the brain. If you look at the channeling phenomena, I know that's not really scientific, but something seems to be happening, even remote viewing, all the things you mentioned, all points to the fact that the brain is a receiver of thought. It's as if like a radio, the radio produces the sound, but the sound is actually coming from someplace else. So I think that's another metaphor for our times that we can point to. If the radio goes dead, it doesn't mean the signal has stopped being transmitted.
Right.
And so I think what I'm sort of looking towards is a paradigm of experience. And I don't think we can only play so much to these people who don't want. I mean, maybe you're different because you're in the science field. I mean, I don't have to really. I'm out there exploring the outer edges and feeling like, okay, if they don't want to accept it, they're going to miss a whole beautiful possible reality that does exist and is becoming more and more apparent. The fact that subjective experience or experience itself is the owner of what's possible. No one can argue with someone else's experience. And,
no, that's right, yeah.
And I think it comes down to even what you were doing with the power of prayer. I mean, yeah, maybe there's no solid science, but people prayed and people got better. And we're still in an infancy of creating these new ways of looking at the world. And work of yours is setting a foundation for building on these new realities. So,
yeah, I want to come back to what I think is a new reality, and that's the fact that there is indeed solid science behind the remote effects of healing intentions and prayers. There was one review recently that found over 100 controlled laboratory and clinical studies that were double-blind and published in peer-reviewed literature that shows in two-thirds of the cases that the remote healing effects are real. This is not trivial. This is a science. This is a huge, huge database. So I just want to say that the game has changed. There was a time when people could say, well, this is just all anecdote and people's personal experience. Well, it is anecdote and people's personal experience, but that's not all it is. And so now we have the making of a of a science that follows the same rules that science follows in other areas. And so it's time we, I think, were very firm and emphatic about that. Now, this is not just, you know, people's stories anymore. This is beyond anecdote. And I think it's time we just stood up with a full-throated voice and said, look, here's the data. Ignore it at your own stupidity.
Right. But I think something comes down to the way scientists think, right? Isn't there, like, the scientific method where, I mean, there needs to be a revision of what we call science, perhaps, as well. You know, because the way it seems like science, I mean, using that left brain I'm talking about versus a kind of right brain, I guess my question is, how do we integrate the right brain intuitive awareness into science in general?
Well, if you go back and look at the history of creativity and invention and discovery, I think you can make an extraordinary case that right brain intuitive approaches were prominent all along. There are several books that do this. David Peet's books on synchronicity and creativity go through the history of science and pull out episodes from the lives of great scientists whose breakthroughs came to them in dreams, in reverie, in imagery, and so on. Even Einstein said that he saw what happens, and then he dressed it up in mathematics later. So it is possible to just delete all of that and say that this is all left-brain logic and analysis, but that's not being true to the history of science the way it really works.
So it's premonitions then, in a way, as well. You're saying that science, I mean, those things are in a way a premonition.
Oh, absolutely. I think where people get stuck is to continue to define science as Galileo and Newton saw it, as just some, as the study of some phenomena that were out there in the world that were totally objective, and you're not a participant. You're really a voyeur. You're just an onlooker. You're not a participant. But that view of how consciousness relates to the world has been discarded for the better part of three quarters of a century since the quantum relativistic revolution. And if you read scientific theorists who don't mind talking in these terms, then you can see that consciousness is now acknowledged to play a pivotal role in how certain aspects of the world behave. Even something as elemental as something called the double slit experiment, where people try to figure out whether an electron is a wave or a particle, rely upon the role of the observer. That's just a code word for consciousness. You can't get around consciousness. What we live in now is what has been called a participatory universe. So I think that the question you ask about how do you hook up the right brain with the left brain in an evolving model of science, I think it's already been done.
Right. So what, I mean, so you, there is this evidence, there is actual documented proof for the power of prayer and these ideas of premonition. You've documented, you've done the science. Why won't people look at this and say, yeah, I mean, we talked about it a little bit, but what is the main, what keeps people stuck?
I think several things, Alan. I think it's just crucial to really acknowledge that scientists have egos and personalities and fears and just like anybody else. I mean, you know, they even are guilty of tremendous bigotry and prejudice, even when they're doing science. This is just a fact. And people get stuck in their own worldviews. I think many scientists get so stuck with their view of how the world works that they come to identify themselves with their worldview. And if you question their worldview, they experience it as a personal attack. you're attacking them, not the worldview. They become so closely wedded to it. And so, you know, they can be as bigoted and prejudicial as anybody. I mean, just because somebody calls themselves a skeptic or a scientist doesn't mean that they're neutral and aren't swayed by the prejudices that everybody else is swayed by.
Go ahead. No, along those lines is how can we teach people to look at science without being attached to what they their worldview in a way, I guess.
Well, I think that this is where personality maturation and even spiritual growth come in. The people I know in science who are able to take a neutral approach most effectively and consistently are people who have done some sort of inner work or spiritual work where ego is transcended to a major degree. These are the people who don't feel threatened if their pet projects and theories aren't validated by the next wave of scientific revelations. So I think that that's part of it. If you look at a lot of the people who you've had on your show, I noticed from your guest list, people like Deepak Chopra, and there are other people I could mention, like people like Fred Wolf or Rupert Sheldrake. These are people who have done a tremendous amount of inner work and don't have their egos out front. And these are people who are generally quite tolerant to the emerging views of consciousness and how it interacts with the world. And so that's one way of looking at how we get there in terms of looking at data dispassionately.
So let's say, let's look into the future and say, yes, we are now living in a society that does acknowledge the power of consciousness, the power of prayer and premonitions and intuitions, which is the society I think we're building in this subculture we've created. But if it exists, if it becomes a worldwide reality, how will the world look to you? What can you imagine the kind of structures that will be in place in this new world?
Well, I think it would be a much less competitive world. I think it would be a world where we make very few distinctions between our welfare as a species and the welfare of other species. We will have a reverence for the world. There will be a greater sense of stewardship. And there will be a greater sense of empathy and altruism on the part of individuals collectively. I think that it will become a much less materialistic world as well. It will be a sustainable world instead of a world that we simply see as a source for extraction. And I think it will be a much nicer place to be alive. I think things that we sort of put in quotation marks sometimes these days, such as compassion and empathy and love, will be taken for granted and accorded a huge factor in how humans should relate to each other. I think also the fear of death will diminish. I say that because if we really believe that our minds are in some sense non-local, that means that they're infinite in time and therefore immortal. If we really believe that, Alan, the fear of extermination with bodily death would attenuate. We would not fear that when our bodies die that it's all over. So I think a sense of soulfulness, a sense that something about us is immortal and eternal, would really go a long way in allaying the desire, the fears that people live with. I happen, in my career as a physician, I believe that the fear of death has caused more pain and suffering for people than all the physical diseases put together. And I think that we see a cure for that. And it's the cure. The cure is the realization that our consciousness is indeed non-local in time, therefore immortal and eternal.
What was the point in your life, or maybe you always had that, where you realized this power of immortality and consciousness? Was there a turning point for you?
I can't point to a specific turning point. For me, there were no grand epiphanies or, moments when the lightning came down. Nothing of that sort. I've never had a near-death experience, which many people credit as a major turning point in their life. For me, it's just simply been a gradual process of increasing certainty and believe that that's just the way we're constituted.
Yeah. But and there's I get from you a sense of openness and compassion, and the increase of that compassion, I think, opens us up to more possibilities of what is human.
Well, yeah, I've recently begun to consider the social and ethical and moral implications of non-local mind. And if you believe that our consciousness is non-local, then what that is saying, that you can't put it in a box and you can't really talk about individual consciousness, because there are no boundaries with non-locality. They, in some sense, all consciousnesses get together and form what the great physicist Schrodinger called the universal or the one mind. This is just a straight arrow logic. If you reason what the implications of non-local consciousness really are. Now, if we believe that our consciousnesses were connected with all other minds in some sense, this would make possible a revision of the golden rule, which says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, which, when you think about it, is sort of a selfish thing. You would be able to revise the golden rule to say something like, be good or be kind to others, because in some sense they are you. This really ups the ante from an ethical and moral point of view, in my judgment. If we really believe that we were one with other people, that there were no absolute barriers separating individuals, I happen to believe that's the case. And I also believe that all spiritual traditions that are worth their salt have ways of helping people live into that awareness. So I don't know if we're going to get there as a species or not. I certainly hope we do. But if we do, it's going to be a much nicer planet to be on than the one we're on right now.
Well, I think the work you're doing, all of us are trying to make it that nicer place to live. And it is knowing that, I think this understanding of what consciousness is really opens the doorway for connection and compassion. I think that's a really good way of putting that morality somehow excels in this understanding that that consciousness is non-local, because that's me over there. And,
well, I hope people hearing us talk like this, think that, I hope they don't think that we're just indulging in pure metaphor and poetry, although that would be kind of nice anyway. But we keep coming back to this idea that these images that you and I are spinning of consciousness aren't just something we're making up. I've spent decades looking at the underpinnings of these new images. Why are we compelled to go in these directions and think about consciousness in these ways? Well, there's that little piece of language called data, that little pesky four-letter word. I like to keep coming back because I just enjoy the game of science. I mean, I'm used to it. It's something I've done all my life, and I think it's just an interesting game to play. Other people are repelled by that approach. I've got a lot of friends who don't have any use at all for randomized double-blind experiments. But for me, they're fun. And if we can use science to come to these greater images of who we are, then I think that that's a pretty nice approach, because whether anyone likes it or not, science is one of the most powerful factors in our culture, and if we can use it in these ways, I think that's wonderful.
Yes, except the problem, I agree with you, but also the problem with science, it comes to conclusions. So when the Wright brothers said that they built a heavier-than-air flying machine, everyone said it was impossible, because
right.
that was what the science of the day had decided was possible. So, you know, it took them 5 years to actually go and confirm to the world that their flying machine worked because
right.
of science. So,
well, you know, if we could get people on board with non-local mind in 5 years, I'd settle for that, Alan.
All right. Okay.
I think that's really fast.
Well, I think so many of the things you cited definitely points to non-local mind. Those random number generating factors, premonitions. Another thing about premonitions is the fact that that word does make it sound a little ominous, where I think intuitions might be a little more innocent a word. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, intuition is it doesn't carry the implications that these things are forewarnings of ominous happenings. But I don't care what term people apply to it. And a lot of people, particularly in the business community, wouldn't be caught dead talking about business premonitions, but they sure talk about business sense and business intuition. There are 10,000 websites now for business intuition, but not
really
for business premonitions. So people can pick the term they're more comfortable with. I wouldn't argue over the term. I think the important thing is to just acknowledge that these things are quite real, and they've been approved by good studies, and that and people can just, you know, term it however they're comfortable with, in my opinion.
I mean, Joseph Campbell said it's not technology that's going to save the world, it's intuition. And I think, you know, of course, intuitions are happening all the time in business and every aspect. And premonitions seem to be the bigger footstep of intuition, you know. It seems to just be the pronounced, you know, awakening of something bigger coming, and that would be the distinction I would make between premonitions and intuitions. But
I think that's fair, Alan. And but I think there's an even bigger umbrella that takes in both premonitions and intuition, and I think that bigger umbrella is non-local mind.
Yes, and that is the new reality. I really think so, and that includes what you said. Going beyond death and realizing that consciousness is eternal and omnipresent.
Yes.
And it's learning to operate on those levels. And I think the world will change and be more compassionate when those levels of reality are cognized. The other thing I want to just talk to you about is this evolution of humans themselves. As we come together in more coherency, it seems like we're acknowledging subtler feelings, like these undefined senses seem to be making themselves known. Do you get what I'm saying? Means that?
Yeah, I do. I think one of the more subtle senses that I would include is this non-local way of knowing. I think I'm not sure whether more and more people are evolving this sense or whether it's been there all along and we're just taking the wraps off of it and owning it, and it's becoming more obvious. You know, in the sense that before Raymond Moody wrote his famous book on near-death experiences back in the 70s, you never heard anybody talking about having a near-death experience. And now that the lid's off of it with that book and many others, now we know that there's something around 8 to 10 million Americans who say they've had near-death experiences. I'm not sure, as I say, whether what that actually means or how to interpret it, but it certainly is more permissible now to go public with those kinds of senses, isn't it?
Well, yeah, those things, and I get into, on this program anyway, UFOs. What do you think of those experiences that people have had?
I try to confine my ramblings and rantings to things that I at least know a little bit about. And, and I,
well, no,
you know, my opinion about UFOs is really not worth anything because I have not made them an object of study. So I would have to stand on the shoulders of people who know something about it and not my own.
Right. And then there's the whole idea of crop circles. You can't deny that that's a reality, at least for me. I've just explored the outer realms and said, well, yeah, there's a lot more on heaven and earth than we've dreamt of. And I've stood in a crop circle and said, I don't think any humans have made this. So I'm just saying that as a kind of further expansion of what consciousness is and possibly to include it, for myself anyway, in this bigger picture that we're trying to create.
Well, you know, and there's so many people who are doing good work in so many areas that this really is a patchwork quilt where I think we each have to add what we can from our point of view and our experience. And I delight in looking at premonitions and remote healing because they have so many implications for healing and medicine. And for example, I think that it's necessary to talk about premonitions as a form of preventive medicine.
Yeah.
Because they so often warn us of upcoming health issues that if we avoid them, you know, we're going to survive and thrive. So I must admit that my own interest is drawn toward issues that have medical relevance because, you know, that's just my background experience.
Uh-huh. What I think that's very important because obviously they come into our mind to help us, to prevent possibility. So I mean, going back to this whole idea of time, it seems like then time is not set. There is free will. We can interact. The body does have ways of talking to us. It makes the world more alive and more exciting, and it empowers people in a bigger way.
Well, I think that's right. You know, I have a lot of skeptics who try to convince me that we shouldn't make a big deal out of premonitions because the future is fixed, and if people see it and it's bad, then, you know, they can't change it. So you've really done them a disservice by telling them that something awful is going to happen over which they're powerless to change. I don't believe that's the way the world works. You know, we were talking about that woman, young mother, Amanda, who rescued her child before the chandelier crashed. If you were to ask her, is the future fixed or can you act to change it, she would say something like, well, what are you, crazy? She'd say, I just did. You know, I went and I got my baby and saved its life. What do you mean the future is fixed? It wasn't fixed for me. So, you know, philosophers and scientists may argue about whether the future is fixed, but if you talk to real people, like Amanda, they don't have any trouble at all with this idea of free will and intentionality.
Yeah, I think that's a big point of what you're saying, is that premonitions are here to really assist us in changing the future. It gives us power. It gives our non-local consciousness the ability to shift a timeline, if you want to call it that.
Well, that's the way I see it. I think you put it very well. I agree with that completely.
So did you also deal with psychics? Because there's a lot of people who can just deal, and tarot card readers and astrologers. I mean, do you acknowledge some of those gifts that I think are real as well?
I sure do. Yeah, I do that in a section in the book called that deals with the ability of people in the business world to intuit what the stock market is going to do. Actually, the silver futures market is the one I look at. There are several studies using psychics to make money in the markets. One of these was so convincing that it wound up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Long story short, Alan, they can do it. They have done it. It's a matter of record. The point I guess would leave people with is that although it's possible, there seems to be limits. And when greed enters the equations and people try to break the bank with their psychic abilities instead of remaining modest and humble about it, the experiments just fall flat. They lose their shirts. So even though it's possible, greed will surely sabotage these experiments, as has been the case time and time again.
That's an interesting point, how greed might interfere with the coherency that we were talking about before.
Right.
So what else are you working on before we finish? I'm just curious.
Well, I'm the executive editor of a journal called Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing, and I write for that every issue, and that's almost a full-time job. But I am doing another book. I'm exploring the world of miracles, so-called miracles, which has always fascinated me. So stay tuned. There may be a book about miracles shortly.
That's great, because the science, there is a science. Obviously, it's only a miracle because we don't know the science behind the phenomena.
Yeah. Well said. I agree with that, yeah.
So as we know the science, then things come online. I mean, I also like what you quoted in that movie, something unknown is doing, we don't know what, you know, which was a great movie that you had a big part in. But, I mean, we could say something unknown is doing, we don't know what, but it sort of sums it all up in a sense in the bigger picture, right? Or what did you mean by that?
Well, I mean that as hard as we try, we're never going to get rid of all the mystery. So we might as well just sort of be humble about it and just admit that there are limits to what we can know. Now, I'm all for pushing those limits as far as possible. But, you know, just as your dog probably is never going to understand calculus, I imagine there are things out there that we're never going to understand, too. So I think that's just a recognition that borders on common sense, and it's important because it helps prevent arrogance and hubris, and it hopefully will, if people took that for granted, that then it would help science not be so meddlesome and reckless from time to time. So I definitely think something unknown is doing we don't know what, and so that's kind of one of my mottos.
Yeah, no, I think it's great, and you have it written in that movie, you show it written on your stairway. Where was that actually written?
Yeah, it's up on the beams in a hallway in my home. I've stenciled that on the beams as I walk down the hall. I read it. And so I get to look at that many, many times a day.
Well, that was great. Arthur Eddington, right? Sir Arthur Eddington.
Sir Arthur Eddington, the great English astronomer. Yeah. That was his thing.
And that really does sum it up. I mean, ultimately, it's all a mystery in a sense. We are the mystery.
Well, consciousness is the mystery. We are consciousness. And I think it's healthy to admit mystery, Alan. I don't think it's a sign of weakness or debasement at all. I just simply think that's we have very little choice in the matter, as I see it. I mean, we can be grateful for what we know, and we should celebrate what we know, and we should be, you know, thankful for what we know. But let's don't delude ourselves. There are limits to what humans are capable of as we're constituted at this stage in our evolution, in any case.
Well, it's like the horizon. The closer we get to it, it keeps moving. So the mystery is life and consciousness itself, it seems.
Well put. Well put, Alan.
So on the 18th, you'll be talking about some of the things we've covered here. Anything else you want to add about
March
18th?
Yeah, it's going to be a lovely PowerPoint talk, and I'll be covering some of these points and going into some of the things that we didn't address. And I think people will have a sense of fulfillment and will find some things that they'll find fascinating and helpful in how they live their lives. So I want to invite everyone to come out. You know, there's nothing like a New York audience. I've discovered I love talking in New York. You know, people are feisty. They ask questions. They push back. And I'm looking forward to seeing everybody on Thursday night.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing you. That's Larry Dossey. We'll be in New York on March 18th at 310 East 67th Street, New York, New York, being sponsored by the Friends of the Institute of Noetic Science and the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy, March 18th. You can look at the fions.org website. That is F-I-O-N-S. Thank you so much for talking with us tonight.
Thanks, Alan.
And I'll do your website again is what?
Yeah, it's www.dossey.com. That's D-O-S-S-E-Y, dossey.com.
Thank you. Thank you for being a guest on New Realities.
Thanks, Alan.
Talk to Dr. Larry Dossey, especially about his book, The Power of Premonitions. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities, and you can reach me at newrealities.com, and you can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thank you for listening.
I am not dying. I am dancing along in madness. There is no sadness, only the soul of the soul. Ta-da!